There's 1 in 40 people seriously injured by vaccines. It's not hypothetical.
If you're good,
CDC is a vaccine company. They are not doing their job as regulators.
Why?
Anthony Fauci put $500 million of our dollars into that vaccine. And now they've got a vaccine that is too big to fail. I'm not anti-vaccine.
I am asking you the question. What if it was 1 in 1,000?
No, of course not. I'm not going to tell 1 in 1,000 people to die.
I think you overstate it.
Look at the vaccine inserts, Alan.
Masks work.
We're going to kill all these people.
Mandatory vaccination.
We're still going to make a profit, so let's go ahead.
Certainly anybody who runs a pharmaceutical company cares deeply about not killing people.
You can't sue them. There's no discovery. There's nothing. They never get caught.
Do you wear a mask personally?
The flu shot not only primes you for flu, but it primes you for coronavirus. They are unavoidably unsafe.
And would say if there is a safe, and that's crucially important, effective measure that could significantly reduce the contagious impact of a deadly disease like the current pandemic virus, or did just in the last day or two create religious exemptions for private schools, religious schools, in terms of whether employment laws operate on religious schools.
Well, I want to begin by thanking Alan for participating in this debate. And by the way, Patrick, you're familiar, and Alan's familiar with my voice. I want to apologize for that at the outset. It's really bad in the morning, and Alan could only do this in the morning, but hopefully it'll get better as we proceed. I want to thank Alan for participating in this debate. I've actually been trying to do a debate on this issue for 15 years. I've asked Peter Hotez, I've asked Paul Offit, I've asked all of the major leaders of who are promoting vaccines to debate me, and none of them have. And I think it's really important for our democracy to be able to have spirited civil discussions about important issues like this. This is an issue that has been on the news 24 hours a day for the last 4 months. And yet there's no debate happening about this. It's all kind of a repetition of these government orthodoxies and government proclamations. And democracy functions only when we have the free flow of information. And policy is best often crafted in the furnace of heated, spirited debate. It's part of our constitutional system. It's part of Americans' tradition. We invented free speech in this country through the First Amendment, and it ought to be something that we celebrate and that we model for the world. It shouldn't be something where you now have Democratic leaders like Adam Schiff calling on social media sites to censor debate about an important government issue. That shouldn't happen. So I'm very grateful to Alan, who I know loves the First Amendment, for actually agreeing to debate on an issue at which he's at a disadvantage, because I've spent 15 years working on this issue. I'm at a big disadvantage for him, when it comes to talking about constitutional law. And I'm going to try to keep a lot of this debate on my side of the issue to put him at a disadvantage. Oh, let me start out by saying I don't agree with Alan's initial, and this is a very small disagreement, because Alan and I have talked a lot offline, and I think we've come to a place where we really believe this is going to be a conversation, not a debate, because I think on most of the issues, we are in agreement. And he made the qualifiers when he came up, and he said, if it's safe, if it's effective. And I think those are the big ifs. That's the playground where this debate is really happening. And I think in the end, he and I would end up in the same place in that debate. I will make a minor dispute, which is the Jacobson case, which was decided in 1905, was not a case where the state was claiming the power to go into somebody's home and plunge a needle into their arm, or kick down their door and take them by force. The Jacobson actually was a guy who was resisting taking a smallpox vaccine. He was from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the penalty for not taking the vaccine was a $5 fine. So it was like a traffic ticket. he decided to take it. He had been injured in a previous vaccine, so he didn't want to take this one. He took the case to the Supreme Court. He lost, and the remedy was he paid a $5 fine. So I think it's a big, there's a big constitutional chasm between, you know, that remedy, which is paying a fine, and actually going in and holding somebody down and forcibly injecting them. And I'm not convinced that the Supreme Court of the United States at this point would uphold that kind of law 9-0 or 8-1 at all. So let me just say that. Let me now go to the initial place where I think we're in agreement. I think Alan and I are both in agreement that this should be a voluntary program. That if there's mandates, they should be as an ultimate, final, dramatic, drastic remedy. And that really, and the question is, why can't we do a voluntary program? When Alan and I were kids, you know, people wanted to get vaccinated. There was no fear of the statement and so polio vaccines, and people had a tremendous trust in our health regulatory officials. And today that trust has evaporated to the extent where now 50% of the people who are polled in this country are saying they may not take the COVID vaccine, and 27% are a hard no. This is even before the vaccine is developed. Why is that happening? And that's the question I think we really have to ask ourselves. Why do so many Americans no longer trust our regulatory officials and trust this process? And one of the reasons is, you know, vaccines are a very, very interesting and very different kind of medical prerogative, because it's a remedy that is being, it's a medical intervention that is being given to perfectly healthy people to prevent somebody else from getting sick. And it's the only medicine that's given to healthy people. So you would want, and particularly to children who have a whole lifetime in front of them, so you would expect that we would want that particular intervention to have particularly rigorous guarantees that it's safe. Because you're saying to somebody, we are going to make you make this sacrifice for the greater good. You have no health problems, you have zero risk of this disease, yet we are going to force you to undergo a medical intervention. And our side of the bargain should be, well, we want this to be completely safe. And in fact, what we know about vaccines, and this is from HHS's own studies, a 2010 study by the Agency for Healthcare Research, I was commissioned to look at vaccine injury, because CDC for many years had been saying vaccine injury only occurs 1 in 1,000,000. But what AHRQ found, which is a federal agency, they looked at one HMO, which was the Harvard Pilgrim HMO, and they did a machine cluster analysis, in other words, artificial intelligence counting, a very, very accurate counting system. And they said the actual rate of vaccine injury is 2.6%. That means 1 in 40 people get seriously injured by vaccines. And do we want to then, do we have a right to say we are going to impose this intervention on people where there's a 1 in 40 chance that you may get injured in order to protect hypothetical people catching that particular disease? And for anybody, and this I think is something that Alan really has to, I think, Alan, that you need to come to terms with in terms of crafting your own arguments about this. It's not hypothetical that vaccines cause injury and that injuries are not rare. The vaccine courts have paid out $4 billion, and the threshold for getting back into a vaccine court and getting a judgment, HHS admits that fewer than 1% of people who are injured ever even get to court. The other thing is, vaccines are zero liability. So this is an industry that went to Congress in 1996, and they had a diphtheria tetanus pertussis vaccine at that time that was called a causing brain injury of one out of every 300 people. And they said to Congress, we cannot make this, we cannot make vaccines safely. They are unavoidably unsafe. That is the phrase in the statute, unavoidably unsafe. The only reason that we're going to continue to make vaccines is if you give us complete blanket immunity from liability. And Congress gave it to them. So today, you have a product that if it injures you, no matter how negligent the company was, no matter how sloppy the line protocols, no matter how toxic the ingredients they choose to use, no matter how grievous your injury, you cannot sue that company. And that company, therefore, has no incentive to make that product safe. And that should be troubling to any of us who are part of the legal system that is saying we are going to force people to take this intervention. Let me come back to that. Let me address some of the other things, because I think that's actually a complex question, and I think the science is very controversial on that. But let me address some of the earlier things that you said first. One is, this is a rather esoteric discussion, and one that, you know, I'm not going to really drag you into, other than to say this. The proposition and the theology that smallpox and polio were abolished due to vaccination is controversial. That is not a proposition that is universally accepted. And if you notice, all the infectious diseases, whether it was scurvy or tuberculosis, for which there were no vaccines, along with peripheral fever and diphtheria and pertussis and measles, all disappeared at the same time without vaccination. Now, CDC actually examined that, because it became such a part of the orthodoxy of, you know, of vaccines, the idea that smallpox and polio were abolished because of vaccines and these other diseases. They did, John Hopkins and CDC in 2000, did a comprehensive study of that proposition. The study was published in Pediatrics, which is the journal for the American Association of Pediatrics, which is kind of a readout, a fortification for vaccine orthodoxy. So it was it's in a publication very, very friendly and supportive of vaccination. For people who want to look up the study, the lead author is Guyer, G-U-I-E-R. And the conclusion of that study is that the abolishment of mortalities from infectious diseases that took place during the first half of the 20th century had virtually nothing to do with vaccines. It had everything to do with sanitation, with nutrition, with hygiene, with electric refrigerators, with reduction in population densities, and essentially engineering solution, clean water, good food. And that was, and actually there was a guy called Edward Cass, who was the head of Harvard Medical School at that time, who gave a very, very famous speech in which he warned that people who were promoting vaccines and other technologies would try to take credit for those reductions in mortalities from infectious disease. And he said, beware of them, because they'll try to monitor that, they'll try to monetize them and use that to increase their power and their prestige. So it's something that you might look at again. It's called Guyer, G-U-I-E-R. I agree with you, there was tremendous faith in vaccination during that period. But when you grew up, I grew up, Alan, we had three vaccines, and all of them were deemed as necessary. There were feared diseases. Today's kids have to take 72 vaccines, 72 doses of 16 vaccines in order to stay in school. And that explosion of new vaccination came in 1989, right after the passage of VICA, Vaccine Act. The Vaccine Act gave blanket immunity from liability to vaccine companies. And so those companies all of a sudden looked around and they said, holy cow, now we've got a product where we are completely excused from the highest cost from that afflicts every other medical product, which is the downstream liability for injuries. That's the biggest cost for every medicine. Not only that, vaccines have another exemption that most people don't know about. They are the only medical product that does not have to be safety tested against a placebo. And that is, that exemption is an artifact of CDC's legacy as the public health service, which was a quasi-military agency, which is why people at CDC have military ranks like Surgeon General and they wear uniforms. The vaccine program was conceived as a national security defense against biological attacks on our country, and they wanted to make sure that if the Russians attacked us with a biological agent, anthrax or something like that, that we could quickly formulate a vaccine and deploy it to 200 million American civilians without regulatory impediments. They said, if we call it a medicine, we're going to have to test it. And that takes 5 years to do double-blind placebo testing. So let's call it something else. We'll call it a biologic and we'll exempt biologics from safety testing. So not a single one of the vaccines, the 72 vaccines now administered to our children, have ever been tested against a placebo. And I, in fact, sued HHS in 2016 and said, show me any placebo studies that you have for any vaccines. And they were unable to do so. None of them have been tested. And you don't have to sue them like I did. Anybody can go on their cell phone and look up manufacturer's insert, hepatitis B vaccine, Gardasil vaccine, polio vaccine. Do you know how many days the current polio vaccine, do you know how many days it was safety tested for, Alan? 48 hours. Yeah. The hepatitis B vaccine, the Glaxo version was 4 days. The Merck version, 5 days. That means that if the baby they gave that to had a seizure on day six, it never happened. If the baby died on day six, it never happened. If the baby got food allergies that were diagnosed 2 years later, it never happened. If the baby got autism, which is not diagnosed till 4 years of age, 4.2 years of age, it never happened. Autoimmune diseases, you cannot see those if you have these short-term studies and you can't see any risk if you don't test against a placebo. And my question is, nobody knows, because of that, nobody knows the risk profile for any vaccine that is currently on the schedule. And that means nobody can say with any scientific certainty that that vaccine is averting more injuries and deaths than it's causing. And my question is, how in the heck can we be mandating to children that they take a medical product for which we do not know the risks? And to me, that is criminal. And, you know, we started this discussion by talking about how do you avoid the whole discussion about mandating vaccines. The way that you do that is you have a transparent process at where people see that the vaccine is going to be tested. They see that it's tested fairly against a placebo, that there's long-term tests that are going to be able to spot all of these difficulties, and that it's transparent and open. And yet what we've seen from the current group of COVID vaccines is none of that's happening. They're skipping key parts of the test. A Moderna vaccine, which is the lead candidate, skipped the animal testing altogether. When they came to human testing, they tested it on 45 people. They had a high dose group of 15 people, a medium dose group of 15 people, and a low dose group of 15 people. In the low dose group, one of the people got so sick from the vaccine, they had to be hospitalized. That's 6%. In the high dose group, three people got so sick, they had to be hospitalized. That's 20%. They're going ahead and making 2 billion doses of that vaccine. And by the way, the people that they test them on, Alan, are not typical Americans. They use what they call exclusionary criteria. They are only giving these vaccines in these tests that they're doing to the healthiest people. If you look at their exclusionary criteria, you cannot be pregnant. You cannot be overweight. You must have never smoked a cigarette. You must have never vaped. You must have no respiratory problems in your family. You can't suffer asthma. You can't have diabetes. You can't have rheumatoid arthritis or any autoimmune disease. There has to be no history of seizure in your family. These are the people they're testing the vaccine on. But that's not who they're going to give them to. They're going to go, what happens? These people are like the Avengers. They're like Superman. You can shoot them with a bullet and they won't go down. But what happens when they give them to the typical American, you know, Sally Sixpack and Joe Bag of Donuts, who's 50 pounds overweight and has diabetes? What is, you know, what is going to happen then? You're not going to see 20%. You're going to see a lot of people dropping dead. These people lost consciousness. They had to go to the hospital. They had huge fevers. And they're the healthiest people in the world. So any other medicine, Alan, that had that kind of profile in its original phase one study would be DOA. The problem is, Anthony Fauci put $500 million of our dollars into that vaccine. He owns half the patent. He has five guys working for him who are entitled to collect royalties from that. So you have a corrupt system, and now they've got a vaccine that is too big to fail. And instead of saying, hey, this was a terrible, terrible mistake, they're saying, we are going to order 2 billion doses of this. And you got to understand, Alan, with these COVID vaccines, these companies are playing with house money. They're not spending anything on it, and they have no liability. So if they kill 20 people or 200 people, 2,000 people in their clinical trials, big deal. They have zero liability. And guess what? They've wasted none of their money because we're giving them the money to play with. Oh, you know, people like me and people in our community are looking at this process and we're saying, oh, you know, whatever comes out of that process, we don't want to take it because we're seeing how the sausage gets made. And it's really sickening. No medical product in the world would be able to go forward with the profile that Moderna has. And, here's the answer. You raise a bunch of questions. One is, the opiate people got busted, Alan, and by the way, no, they were not moral people. They knew what they were doing. They're killing 56,000 American young kids a year, knowing what they were doing. More kids every year that were killed in the 20-year Vietnam War. These are not moral companies. And they only got busted because plaintiff's attorneys could sue them.
I agree.
They got the discovery documents and walked them down to the U.S. Attorney's Office and said, hey, there's criminal behavior here. That can never happen in the vaccine space. You can't sue them. There's no discovery. There's no depositions. There's no class action suit. There's no district litigation. There's no interrogatories, nothing. They never get caught. Now, these four companies that make all of our vaccines, all 72 of the vaccine shots that are now mandated for our children, every one of them is a convicted serial felon. Glaxo, Sanofi, Pfizer, Merck, in the past 10 years, just in the last decade, those companies have paid $35 billion in criminal penalties, damages, fines, for lying to doctors, for defrauding science, for falsifying science, for killing hundreds of thousands of Americans knowingly and getting away with it. Vioxx, which was Merck's the biggest vaccine producer, Vioxx, which was their flagship product in 2007, was a pill that they marketed as a headache pill that caused heart attacks. they knew it caused heart attacks because they saw them in the signals in their clinical trials. They didn't tell the American public. And they killed between 120,000 and 500,000 Americans who did not need to die. And most of those Americans were people who had rheumatoid arthritis or they had headaches and migraines. They took that pill, believing, and by the way, when we sued them, we got spreadsheets from their bean counters where they said, we're going to kill all these people. We're still going to make a profit, so let's go ahead.
Nobody can justify that. I agree with
right.
you completely.
And nobody. They should have all gone to prison and said they paid a $7 billion fine. But how can anybody? It requires a cognitive dissonance for people who understand the criminal corporate cultures of these four companies to believe that they're doing this in every other product that they have, but they're not doing it with vaccines. They are. Look, and I just want to answer your other question. No, sure. Placebo testing does not take place after the clinical trials. And the reason for that is that HHS has adopted a very unethical guidance that says it is unethical once a vaccine is licensed recommended. It is unethical to do placebo trials or compare vaccinated versus unvaccinated people. There are scientists who do it, but they're punished for it. It's very difficult for them to publish. They get their funding cut off because nobody wants any study that is going to reveal the truth about vaccine injuries. So it just does not happen.
Look, it's communicable diseases. Wouldn't you agree that mandatory mask wearing would be constitutional?
Well, if I accepted all of your precedents, then perhaps I would. The thing is, I know a lot about the mask, and my organization, CHD, has not taken a position on them. But I have read, I've read at least three meta reviews involving hundreds of studies on masks. And the majority of the studies, in fact, there's a BMJ study from 2015 that says that the mask is actually likely to spread the disease and to make you less healthy because the carbon dioxide that you're breathing and that the people who wear the mask are more likely to get sick. I'm not saying that that's my position. I'm just saying there's a lot of contrary science out there.
Do you wear a mask personally when you go out?
If the science was clear, then I'd be much more sympathetic to your view. Let me ask you this. Let me just answer the other question you had. You said we have to rely on the majority. Well, I grew up in the state of Virginia, Alan. When I grew up, it was illegal because the majority voted that it was illegal for a black man to marry a white woman.
It was illegal
for blacks to vote. So the majority is not, no. In a democracy, you have the courts there that protect our rights.
I agree.
And unfortunately, we are in a situation today where we have tremendous corruption, not only in Congress, which receives more money from pharmaceutical companies than any other industry. Pharmaceutical gives in lobbying twice the amount that oil and gas, which is the next big one, four times with defense and aerospace. There are more lobbyists, pharma lobbyists in Congress than there are members of Congress in the Senate. So anyway, we have lost the legislative independence of that body. And unfortunately, Alan, the agencies are also captured. Now, you know about agency capture. It happens everywhere. And I've sued EPA my entire life. We just sued EPA. We just sued Monsanto. We got an historic judgment, a $12 billion settlement in the Monsanto case. And I was part of that trial team. And one of the things that happened during that trial is that EPA took a position against us. They took a position that glyphosate does not cause cancer. As it turns out, we got internal memorandum that showed that the head of the pesticide division in EPA was actually working secretly for Monsanto and killing studies and twisting studies and ghostwriting studies to falsify the science.
Look, you're doing
we were able to show that to the jury. Now, imagine this. That's EPA, which is an independent agency. Imagine this. FDA, that's 50% of its budget from vaccine companies, from the industry, 50%. The CDC has an $11.5 billion budget, and $4.9 billion of that is buying and selling and distributing vaccines. CDC is a vaccine company. It owns 57 vaccine patents, so it can make money on every sale of a vaccine. NIH owns hundreds of vaccine patents. NIH owns half the patent for the Moderna vaccine. There's five individuals at NIH, and the rules at NIH, if you're a scientist or an official who worked on a vaccine, you're allowed to collect $150,000 a year in royalties on sales that that vaccine makes. These regulatory agencies are actually vaccine companies. The vaccine marketing sales part of those agencies is the tail that is now wagging the regulatory dog. They are not doing their job as regulators. And in fact, the senior scientist at CDC today, the senior vaccine safety scientist, who's been, in fact, he's still at CDC, he was the senior scientist there for 18 years. He is the author or co-author on all of the major studies that CDC has produced on vaccine safety, and particularly the studies that show the vaccine does not cause autism. His name is Dr. William Thompson. 3 years ago, he came forward and he said, we have been ordered to fake all the science of the last decade on autism. And he said, in fact, we were in the major study, which is called the Stefano 2004. It's the most cited study on this subject on PubMed. And he said, in that study, we found out that black boys who get the MMR vaccine had a 363% greater risk of getting an autism diagnosis than black boys who waited after 36 months. Right. He said he was ordered to come into a conference room with all that data, with his four other co-authors, by their CDC boss, Frank DiStefano, who then ordered them to destroy that data in front of them in CDC headquarters, and then published that study saying there is no effect. So you have an agency that is really just an arm of industry, and the people who are in my community who are being derided and vilified, these mothers who have vaccine-injured children, are being vilified in the press, who are saying, wait a minute, we have read the studies, the scientific studies. We have read about the industry corruption. We need to talk about this. They're being silenced by the press. They're not allowed to tell their stories, and nobody is talking. Not a single member of Anderson Cooper's staff or Sanjay Gupta has made any effort to talk to Bill Thompson, and he has been begging to be subpoenaed, and he's still at CDC.
Mm-hmm. Look, the reason I need to do this debate is because I think you perform an important function by bringing out some of these ties, some of these connections. You perform an important function when you bring lawsuits against corrupt pharmaceutical companies. But my question is this, knowing all that you know now, and putting aside the issue of, let's assume we didn't have mandatory vaccinations. Let's assume you win that debate. And it's only voluntary vaccinations now. And they come forward with a vaccine that they say will stem the tide of the pandemic. And you're allowed to go on television on Anderson Cooper. Would you urge all the American people not to take the vaccine? Would you become part of the campaign not to take the vaccine if it were voluntary?
I'm not anti-vaccine. People call me anti-vaccine because of the way of marginalizing me and silencing me and saying,
why I'm asking you the question.
I'm not anti-vaccine. You know, look, Alan, I've been trying to get mercury out of fish for 37 years. Nobody calls me Annie Fish.
God bless you. I support you 100%. But what would you do?
What
would you tell the American public if a vaccine were available and if you were invited, say, to speak to members of the Black community, members of the Latino community, members of the general American community, and they said,
if they come out with the vaccine, it does what Bill Gates says it's going to do, which is you give one shot, you get lifetime immunity, and there are vanishingly rare serious injuries. So I don't mind, you know, jab site, redness, itching, forget about it. I don't care. I'm talking about deaths for brain damage, 1 in 1,000,000. That may be acceptable. In that case, and it works, and I'd say, I tell people, yeah, I'm going to get it. Let's go ahead and get it.
What if it was one in a thousand, not 1 in 1,000,000? That's more
realistic. 1 in 1,000? No, of course not. I'm not going to tell 1 in 1,000 people to die so that 999 people can avoid COVID, particularly since the case fatality rate for COVID, I mean, a healthy person has basically zero chance of dying from COVID. So they, you know, you need to give it to a tremendous number of people to save one life. And the problem is with this vaccine is we don't know if the vaccine is going to kill more people when you start giving it to those people with the comorbidities. 54% of Americans now has diabetes, overweight, rheumatoid arthritis, they're smokers. They have 54% of us. I'm not even talking about smokers and vapors. 54% of us has chronic disease. They're testing it on one group and they're going to give it to another. And we need to know what the risk factor is in the people that they give it to. And
I agree with that. Let me put you in a
let me just say the complete thought I was going to be made before. You know, I've sued the EPA for many years, and it's a captive agency. What would happen if EPA made half of its annual budget selling coal? Mm-hmm. That's what you got with these regulatory agencies.
They're completely corrupt.
The problem is, you know, that sounds like a reasonable position. The problem is, it's not the world the way the world works. And let me explain why. Here's how the world works. And the best analogy is the flu vaccine. So the flu vaccine is very much like the coronavirus vaccine, but we've had the flu vaccine for 90 years. So every year it's fine-tuned and perfected. And originally they told us the flu vaccine, you'll give one shot and you'll have immunity for life. And then it turned out, no, we need to get it every year.
Because there are variations of the flu.
Right, and that's the same thing is highly likely to happen with coronavirus. Yeah. Now, the Cochrane Collaboration, which is the ultimate arbiter for vaccine safety, it is the highest authority. And the British Medical Journal have done 3 giant meta-reviews on the flu vaccine literature. So they look at all the literature that exists, the peer-reviewed literature that is on PubMed, I think 127 studies. They did it in 2010, 2014, and 2017. Here's what they found. CDC said the flu vaccine is 35% effective. That's what they claim. Cochrane Collaboration said, no, you have to give 100 flu shots to prevent one case of flu, number one. Number two, there is zero evidence that the flu shot prevents any hospitalizations or any deaths. Number three, the flu shot transmits the flu. In fact, if you get a flu shot, you're 6 times more likely to give somebody else the flu than if you didn't get the flu shot. And this is true, Alan, for many, many other shots. For example, the polio vaccine, which you know about, is so good at transmitting, giving polio to other people that 70% of the polio cases in the world today come from the vaccine.
So let me ask you a specific question.
And the chicken pox, if you go to the chicken pox manufacturer's insert, It says if you get this chickenpox vaccine, you should not go near a pregnant woman for 6 weeks or anybody with who's immunocompromised. Yeah. Same with pertussis. You become an asymptomatic carrier. So it's a, you're not guaranteeing. And in fact, the AstraZeneca vaccine, the Oxford vaccine, which is the other leader, when they gave it to monkeys, the monkeys continued to transmit the disease. And Bill Gates and Fauci have been going on TV saying, you know, we may get a vaccine that protects you, but it, you may still be transmitting it. So why are you going to lock that guy up in a house?
Look,
and
I call
people out who are now asymptomatic carriers because they got Gates' vaccine. Nobody should listen to me. People need to do the science themselves. And I would say to you, no, listen to your doctor. What Reagan said about Gorbachev, trust but verify. Do look at the vaccine inserts, Alan.
Yeah.
Look at some of the science. And I would say, you know, in a million years, I would not take the flu shot. And I'll tell you why, because this is what Cochrane and BMJ have found. People who take the flu shot are protected against that strain of flu. They're 4.4 times more likely to get a non-flu infection. And you might find, and a lot of people do, that they get the flu shot and then they get sick. They're usually not getting the flu. Or getting something that is indistinguishable from the flu, because the flu shot gives you something called pathogenic priming. It injures your immune system so that you're more likely to get a non-flu viral upper respiratory infection. In fact, the Pentagon published a story, and you can cite this, it's by Wolf, W-O-L-F-E, in January of this year, in which they said that the flu shot not only primes you for flu, but it primes you for coronavirus. If you get, they had a placebo group and they had a vaccine group because they wanted for military readiness to see if the flu shot was prophylactic against coronavirus. What they found is actually the people who got the flu shot were 36% more likely to get coronavirus. And that's not a lone study. We found six other major studies that say the same thing. If you get the flu shot, you're more likely to get coronavirus. And this is what the science says, and you should not listen to me. Nobody should.
Yeah, I understand.
You should read the science.
Simplifications of your view correctly.
Yeah, but I wouldn't take that sort of extreme position. What I would say is we should have vaccines, but we shouldn't have one-size-fits-all mandates. There may be some situations where even a flu shot would be beneficial to somebody, because a flu shot is not completely ineffective. It does probably give you protection against that year's flu strain if they get it right. And there could be a situation where somebody's life depended on getting that flu shot, but to mandate the flu shot population-wide, I think, is criminal. And I think it's, you know, all you have to do, Alan, and this is what Cochrane said, is look what's happened to longevity in the elderly since we started mandating the flu shot to elderly people. Those are the people, their life expectancy has dramatically gone down as the flu shot proliferated. And if you see, you know, the people who died during the COVID crisis, and there's no science on this, but it's observational, it tended to be people who got their flu shots, people who were in nursing home who all get flu shots, people who are first responders who get flu shots. I'm kind of a free market guy, and I think, you know, what I'm against mandates. I think that, you know, there may be situations where, you know, where that product might do some good for somebody, but I just don't believe it should be mandated. I don't, you know, I wouldn't think, for example, that Viagra should be mandated to every human being on the planet, right? But there may be somebody who says, you know, I want to take that medication. Let them do it.
But
let's not order everybody to do it.
Dual choice.
I'm I have a big libertarian streak in me. I think people should be left to their own choices wherever possible, unless it's going to do some harm to others. Let me address one, just one last thing that you were talking about.
We both agree with John.
Yeah, I think we agree on most stuff. You said, well, if it's tested against a placebo, and this, I think, is why people like me are suspicious, are reticent. The Oxford vaccine, which is the other leader. Gates has a huge investment in it. Fauci is pushing it. It is the leader. AstraZeneca is now, is branding it. Well, that vaccine is run by a guy called Greg Pollard, who is at Oxford, a very, very famous, powerful virologist. He originally promised at the beginning, he said, we're going to test it against a placebo. We're going to do what's never been done in vaccinology before. We're going to actually use an inert placebo and test it. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle of his phase two, he said, no, we're going to test it against the meningitis vaccine. The meningitis vaccine is a vaccine with a really high injury profile. It has a listed just on its manufacturing insert are 50 deadly serious injuries, including Kawasaki disease, Guillain-Barre, paralysis, seizure, heart attacks, and death, and hepatitis, and all kinds of autoimmune disease. It's arguably the most dangerous vaccine. So instead of giving his placebo group an inert placebo, he's giving them the most dangerous vaccine he can. Why? It's a ploy that vaccinologists use. And they give their placebo group something that's horrendously dangerous to mask injuries in the vaccine. And so everybody on my side sees this and they say, he's not being honest. We do not know what the risk profile of that product is. We are never going to take that product because it was never tested against a placebo. Make them do the science. Don't say get angry at people who are skeptical and say, oh, you're skeptical. We're watching the sausage get made, and it's an ugly process. And by the way, he gave that vaccine to a bunch of monkeys, macaques. And then he challenged the macaques by exposing them to the wild coronavirus.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of the macaques got sick. So the vaccine doesn't work, but because the British government put £90,000 into it, he now is in order to make 2 million doses with a vaccine we know doesn't work, and they're going forward with it anyway, and he refuses to test it against a placebo. So that gives us zero faith in the whole process. Thank you, Alan. And I want to express my gratitude to you on behalf of myself and everybody in this community. People who are called anti-vax, they're mainly not anti-vaccine. Almost all of them are the mothers and fathers of intellectually disabled kids who gave all the vaccines, who did what they were told, and then their child was injured, and that prompted them to go out and do the research. Those people should be allowed to speak. Those people should not be gagged. They should not be shut up. They should not be talked to. Considered heretics, they should be allowed to tell their story, and they should be treated with compassion and understanding and patience and an intellectual openness toward their stories. They shouldn't be vilified. They shouldn't be gaslighted. They shouldn't be ignored. And right now, particularly at a point in our history where we're talking about giving lots of people this vaccine, their stories are more important to hear than ever. I want to thank you, because for 15 years, all of us have been trying to do a debate, and we haven't been able to get Peter Hotez to do it. We haven't been able to get Paul Offit, Ian Lipkin, any of the leaders. I've been scared to sit where you are now. And I want to thank you so much on behalf of all of us, but also our democratic traditions for coming here. Thank you, Alan.
Well, thank you, Robert.